I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. The Transom Story Workshop is 9 weeks of full-time training for beginning radio producers in Woods Hole and was created by our station founder, Jay Allison. Students have a microphone in hand on day one, and by the end of the 9 weeks, they've produced a ready-to-air radio piece. Rob Rosenthal is the lead instructor of the workshop, and he joins us in studio to talk about the spring and fall classes of 2017 and what they produced. Welcome back.
I missed you last spring.
I know.
We normally do this every workshop.
But... I know, and I think I was out sick or something, right?
Well, here we are. I'm really glad to be back and playing student stories.
Yeah, and we remind listeners why the Transom Story Workshop was created. What were the goals that you and Jay and the others set up for the workshop?
You know, I think to put it simply is I feel like it's my job and our job at Transom is to sort of catapult people into public media, to take people who are who've never produced radio stories before or who have dabbled and as best we can, with their help, turn them into producers at the end of 9 weeks.
And it is really, I always say this, mind-boggling that you have, some of them have at least a little bit of radio experience, but some of them have zero.
No, there are people who have not picked up a microphone before in the class.
And then in 9 weeks, they put together amazing stories.
Yeah, it's a ropes course for me and the teaching assistant and for them too. Yeah.
So we have several long format stories from the students this past year. Is this kind of like their final exam?
Yeah, they get to produce two stories. One is formatted, if you will. It's for the Ways of Life series at WCAI, and it's supposed to be 4.5 minutes long. And so I think by corralling them at first is actually pretty useful. You know, to take a new producer and let them be infinite in all directions, I don't think that's good for anybody. But their second stories, after they've gotten one under their belt, okay, yeah, let's let it rip. Let's see what happens.
Do whatever you want.
Yeah, in essence. It has to be a story.
Yeah. So what's this first piece that we're going to...
The story is about two sisters from Puerto Rico who relocated to New Bedford after Hurricane Maria. They relocated here with their 8 kids. It's actually not a story.
It's not.
In the sense that if a story is supposed to have a sequence of events where someone changes or comes to some new conclusion or there's evolution from point A to point B, this doesn't have that and it totally works.
Cynthia Melendez is in her hotel room. She's bending over, trying to persuade her 4-year-old nephew to eat lunch. Coaxing him to open his mouth, Cynthia asks him, "Remember how hungry you were?" In the weeks after the storm, while the family was still in Puerto Rico, they would measure their hunger in pigs. "How many pigs are you as hungry as?" she asks him. He takes a bite. Cynthia, her sister Vanessa, and their kids, 10 people in total, arrived in New Bedford nearly a month ago. When the family first got here, they stayed with Cynthia and Vanessa's brother at his house. But he has a wife and 5 kids of his own, as well as a live-in mother-in-law. Altogether, they were 18 crammed in the house, and they were afraid he'd be evicted with all of them there. Cynthia says, "So we went to look for other housing, but no one wanted us because we were too many people." So they moved to a budget hotel called the Whaler Lounge. They're renting 2 rooms there, which costs about $200 per night altogether. Since the sisters aren't working and their FEMA check hasn't come through yet, local organizations help to foot the bill for now. It's Saturday, which means the kids are home from school. 2 teenage girls are braiding one another's hair while they watch a Mexican soap opera on a phone. A boy is flopped on the bed playing video games. Another girl is looking at herself in the mirror.
No tenemos donde llevar los nenes. No tenemos nada de diversión. Hemos
tratado... Cynthia tells me, "We don't have anywhere to take the kids. We don't have any sort of entertainment. We don't have any money." The family has remained remarkably peaceful, considering the tight quarters and the boredom. But Cynthia says, sometimes, when everything feels too hard, too overwhelming, when she just needs a minute for herself, she'll lock herself in the bathroom and cry. Vanessa is standing outside of an assisted living facility. She was hoping to apply for a job here today, but the door to the building is locked. Back in Puerto Rico, she was a nurse, but her license isn't valid here, so for now, she'll take anything she can get.
¿Ustedes están abiertos hoy?
Vanessa calls to see if they're open today.
Okay. Está bien, entonces, gracias. Está cerrado. Lunes a viernes, de 9 a 5.
So it's only open Monday through Friday, 9 to 5?
Sí.
She'll have to wait until Monday to apply. For Vanessa and her family, that's two more days without an income.
Realmente nosotros queremos trabajar.
Cynthia says, we want to work.
Estamos en esto no porque queremos, sino por la situación.
We're not here because we want to be here, but because of the situation that happened in Puerto Rico. That's how she and Vanessa always refer to the storm. The situation. She says, we had our jobs, we had everything there. Vanessa says, here we have nothing. In response to the influx of Puerto Rican hurricane survivors, a bunch of local organizations have joined together to help support the families, like Mobile Ministries. It's basically a church on wheels. They provide food, clothing, and Jesus to those in need.
A, B, C, D.
The Melendez family arrives before the truck is open, so while the volunteers set up, Cynthia's 11-year-old daughter is practicing her English. When she gets to Z, she says, that's all I know so far. Eventually, lunch is ready. But first,
see, Jesus right there puts light and life together.
All of the regulars stand in a semicircle around the preacher and hold hands. Some close their eyes, others bow their heads. Cynthia, Vanessa, and the kids are unsure about what to do. So they stand just outside the semicircle and form a line of their own, clasping hands. They're quiet and respectful, but their eyes are focused on what sits just behind the preacher in the back of the truck. Lunch.
Hi, sweetie. Want a hot dog? Come on in.
The older kids are embarrassed to go up, so they ask their moms to get food for them. Cynthia tells me, it's not easy bringing the kids here. She's afraid people will judge them for taking handouts. After lunch, the family picks out a few bags of clothes before leaving. I notice a slip of paper in one of the bags that reads, Free Pass to Heaven. A few days later, while the kids are in school, Vanessa heads to North Star Learning Center. North Star is a childhood development organization. Vanessa's filling out an application to become a substitute teaching assistant, and Cynthia comes along for moral support. Vanessa is nervous. She sits in the waiting room, clutching her blue plastic file organizer against her chest.
Hi, I'm Norma.
Hi, I'm Vanessa. Vanessa.
Hi.
This is Norma Alvarez. She's the director of operations at North Star.
¿Tiene los papeles que necesita para hacer copia?
Birth certificate, right?
The job is only part-time and pays minimum wage, which in Massachusetts is $11 an hour. When she's finished filling out the application, Norma tells Vanessa the job is hers. But before she can start working, they have to wait for the background check to come through. And that can take anywhere from a week to a month. Next, the sisters head to United Way, an organization that's been helping them with their resettlement. When they arrive at the office, Cynthia and Vanessa find six bags of winter clothes waiting for them. They have to catch the bus home. They look down at all the bags slumped at their feet, then at each other. They struggle to collect the bags and start walking to the bus stop. They make it 20 feet before needing a break. A few minutes later, they need another break. Halfway there, Vanessa hears something. The bus is coming. They're still a few blocks from the bus stop, so they start running, the plastic bags banging against their legs. In the next week, both sisters will get colds. Cynthia will get a job at a restaurant that pays her $5 an hour, and Vanessa will continue to wait to hear from North Star. The sisters will run out of money and leave the hotel. Cynthia says they'll go to their brother with what she describes as the only face they have, their heads hung. They'll ask him, can you take us back? He'll worry they'll be evicted, but we'll welcome them anyway. The sisters will even wonder if they should go back to Puerto Rico, even though they know they'd be worse off there. But right now, Cynthia and Vanessa are running for a bus. They're too late. The bus drives off. Cynthia says, sometimes it's better to laugh than cry. For WCAI, I'm Aviva de Kornfeld in New Bedford.
How do the students come up with topics and then find the people to interview?
You know, in this particular case, Aviva knew that some 200 people had relocated to New Bedford at the time she had reported the story, relocated from Puerto Rico after the hurricane. And it was just something that she, when in looking through the newspaper, she hadn't really seen the voice of anybody who had actually been relocated. There were quotes in newspaper reports from people providing services and that sort of thing, but no actual people from Puerto Rico in the stories. And so I don't know if most of them speak Spanish and the reporters don't. But Aviva speaks Spanish, and so she was able to find these two women and spend a good deal of time with them. She had trouble finding them. Mm-hmm. She called me from New Bedford, and she said, Rob, I can't find them, and I'm not going to leave. In fact, I've put my keys in the bottom of my bag to make it harder for me to leave New Bedford, but what should I do? Where should I go? Where should I look? And so we brainstormed some things, and she eventually came across these women.
Now, these students come from all over the place. When they come, was it eight students?
Nine.
All right, so I would imagine sometimes you get some of the same story pitches, right?
Yeah, I mean, stories about aging, that happens here. Stories about erosion, sure. I mean, the things that are the common themes reported on WCAI and the Cape Cod Times and the newspapers and that sort of thing, those pop up in class as well. But oftentimes the students find stories that are somewhat off the mark. I think our next story is a little bit, you know, not a fully hidden story, but a kind of hidden story.
All right, we're going to hear that after a short break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the Transom Story Workshop, training the next generation of radio producers with Rob Rosenthal, who's the lead instructor. And we are about to hear another story produced by one of the students, okay, graduate now. What's this one about?
Well, it's another story that's kind of sad. The first one was, you know, pretty dark. This one's sad as well, but rather uplifting toward the end. It's about home burial. And that's a thing. People, I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but I think with increasing frequency, more and more people are deciding not to necessarily hand over all of the responsibilities of taking care of a dead family member and handing it over to a funeral home. They're deciding to take on some of those responsibilities themselves. And so a student from last spring, Abby Madan, she decided to do a story about one person's home burial experience.
Larry Mortel was a barber. His daughter Fran says that when customers entered his shop, he'd collect their stories like souvenirs. She also saw his other side, tattered t-shirts and playful sarcasm, and his music. He had a very particular taste in music.
He loved classical music. The older he got, it was clearly, strictly classical music.
Even at 93, Larry was physically fit. Fran says he would turn every chore around the house into a mini workout.
Whether he was reaching something from the cabinet, he would get the step stool and make that, like do 10 repetitions, up, down, up. You know, that was an opportunity to do an exercise.
4 years ago, Larry died at Fran's house. Fran was unprepared. She had no idea what to do next.
Then we're faced with, oh my God, he died. You know, like he died. What do we do now?
Fran says that her father had lost the will to live. He was severely depressed, so caring for him in his last few months was difficult. Still, Fran knew she wanted to continue doing it for just a little longer. It felt natural. Her sister Sue and her three nieces were there to help.
I think what we immediately did was join hands and embrace that moment.
Fran and Sue then cleaned their dad Larry's body with frankincense oil. They lit 15 candles and placed them around his bed, one for each person in the family. Then a nurse came to pronounce him dead.
Her wanting to be helpful said, well, which funeral home should I call?
But the idea of involving a funeral home felt unnatural to Fran. She knew that her dad wanted to be cremated, but he'd left no other instructions. She wondered, what if she could be her father's funeral director here at home? That's when she thought of Heather Massey.
She called and said, it happened.
Heather is a home death guide.
I am really there to help people with making after-death care plans for their loved ones. In other words, caring for the body at home or within community.
Heather had arranged a home funeral for her mother 2 years earlier. When Fran heard about it, she was intrigued. She didn't know it was even legal to care for the dead at home. On the phone, Heather told Fran to act fast.
You know, you have 24 hours before you really have to start chilling the body and keeping the internal organs from decomposing. You know, you really have to get ice on him.
Bathing them, cooling the body down, dressing them.
Very, very, very thorough cleaning of the body.
Temperature of the water.
She had the ice packs for us.
Types of soap to use.
Now she's handing us cotton swabs. Good for getting into the nose cavity.
When Fran got home from Heather's, it was dark. She was overwhelmed. She'd never dealt with a dead body before. Plus, this was her father.
We were a little weirded out. You're taking this cotton swab and putting it up deeper, but you're not sure if you're hurting them. And between my sister and I, we just said, look, let's get a good night's sleep.
When Fran and her sister Sue woke up, they felt ready. They got to work cleaning their father's body, quietly and deliberately. Then they placed packs of ice over his organs and dressed him in clean clothes.
And we weren't grossed out. It was what we had to do, and we were going to do it with love. It was amazing, the transformation that we went through overnight.
Fran kept her father's body for 4 days. On top of preserving the body, there was a death certificate to file, a coffin to buy, a permit to get at town hall so they could transport the body themselves, and a party to plan in his honor. Everyone in the family had a task, small rituals. But at first, Fran says they didn't know how to act like themselves around death.
We were taking this very seriously.
Even though the house was full of family, it was silent. But then, late on the second night, Fran heard coyotes howling in her yard. She says she's always looking for symbols and wondered what that meant.
It just seemed like they were really, really sending us a message. You know, when you hear them, they almost sound like they're playful a little bit. You can really get the sense that they're kind of like down on their paws just through the way they're howling.
The coyotes reminded Fran of how playful her father had been, especially back when he and her mom were both healthy. And then she realized that's how she wanted to approach his death.
You don't have to be so serious. You know, you can let laughter in. And that just broke the ice for us. That just allowed us to honor my father in his, you know, sarcastic, humorous way. We were playing music my father never would have approved of. I didn't have to have classical music on, so I could let myself shine through a little bit more with my own choices and not worry about what he was going to say now, even though he's in the house.
After 3 days of keeping his body at home, Fran hosted a celebration in honor of her dad. The house was packed with people, and Heather was there too. In one corner of the living room, friends decorated a large sheet of cardboard that would later become the coffin. They covered it with phrases and images that reminded them of Larry.
God is love, infinity, symbol, rainbow colors, musical notes, palm trees. The earth does not belong to us. We belong to the earth.
Larry lay in the next room with the door closed. Some people didn't go in. Fran hadn't even told them he was there. She thought they'd freak out. Others slipped in for a visit. On the fourth day, it was time for Fran to take her father to the crematorium. It took the entire family to maneuver the coffin into a rented van. But the hardest part for Fran was letting the body go.
It wasn't until we let go of the body at that moment that it just was like, he's leaving us. We'll never see him again. That was the first time I cried.
Having her father's body at home for days let Fran grieve at her own pace. In her own way.
You have an opportunity to go in the room and spend time with them, not just from 2 to 4 and 7 to 9. You know, you can wake up before you brush your teeth in the morning and go and say, hey, Pa, how you doing?
Fran's mother died 5 months later. She'd been suffering with dementia. Fran took the same steps to care for her. That extra time was precious.
For both my parents, it was their hands that were just so unique to them. whether they were bringing you a plate of food, opening the door from you, hugging you, just all the times that you see their hands in passing and don't think anything about it, now they're here in front of you and you know your time is limited to see the every wrinkle and how the shape of their fingernail is and how their ring fits on their finger and what their knuckles look like.
Saying goodbye this way was a huge effort, but it gave Fran time to appreciate every bit of who her parents were. In Falmouth, Massachusetts, I'm Abby Madan.
It's interesting because I'm thinking of the process of putting these stories together and thinking, no experience doing this. So how much do you have to get involved in that editing process? And they go, they do the interview, and then there's, I imagine there's a lot of back and forth on what you're going to include and, you know, how it's written.
Yeah, so the class, it's actually a collaborative process. So there's 9 people in class. Sometimes we break into 2 groups of 4 and 5. And we think of it as a production team. Mm. So each student is responsible for their own stories, but everyone else pitches in. And so, yeah, I'm involved, but so is everybody else. And on one hand, that's a pretty messy process.
Yeah.
When you have 4 or 5 people telling you how you should be doing something, it can kind of be crazy making. By the same token, it seems like often 4 or 5 brains on something is actually, you know, the better way to go. And ultimately, the decisions lie with the student, unless there's an ethical problem.
Right.
And then we hold up a stop sign and say, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm involved with editing scripts. I'm involved in managing the conversations that happen in class around people's stories. But it's mostly a student effort.
Hmm. So you mentioned this bi-monthly feature that we have called Ways of Life, and some of the stories created by the Transom students make that cut for the feature. So tell us how you prep them for a potential Ways of Life stories.
The idea is this. We, the radio station, I think I can speak on behalf of the radio station, what the station wants for the Ways of Life pieces is, you know, we live here. Why not produce stories that help connect us to one another, to the people who live on the Cape and the South Coast? And so we just ask that the students find interesting people. And we have a checklist of things that, you know, define what interesting is, because not everyone's interesting. And you know, okay, I'm not going to keep
going with
that.
And then there are people who don't think they're interesting, and they are.
Yeah, there's that. Right. Lots of people feel that way. And you kind of want that, because if someone's boasting and say, hey, do a story on me, you're kind of like, huh, I don't know. But anyway, we prep them and we say, look, this is a 4.5-minute feature. You need to find someone who's interesting. And they need to do something that's interesting, ideally, that makes a sound, because this is radio, after all. Mm-hmm. So no mimes, you know, painting, which is the oldest joke in radio. And painting, we've done stories on painters. That's kind of tough.
Yep.
It's a little quiet. Visual arts can be a little difficult. But this student, Matthew Simonson, he lucked out. He totally lucked out. He's into birding, and he found a young birder on Nantucket.
It's 6 a.m. The sun is just beginning to rise. 15-year-old Skylar Cardell sips from his coffee as he strolls through the marsh near his house. A few birds have just woken up.
This is a trick which I sometimes use.
Whenever he can, Skylar is out by Lily Pond Park or the Cranberry Bogs, welcoming the migrant birds that stop by.
Oh, here comes the rose-breasted grosbeak again. Long time no see, friend.
He reaches for the binoculars to get a closer look.
Look at that.
When he can precisely identify a species, either visually or by their call, Skylar pulls out his phone and logs it in his eBird app.
I'm actually pretty excited. These are my first of the season golden crown kinglets.
This is birding, and Skylar's hooked. Somehow, between being a sophomore in high school, cross country, the winter musical, a job, and volunteer work, he makes the time, mostly on Saturdays, to just be there with the birds.
It's definitely a lot to balance with birding, because I'll find myself inside working on a test, and I look out the window, and I'm like, damn, you know, northwest gust today up to 17 miles per hour, this would be perfect.
That feeling of being stuck comes up a lot. Vacationers, like migrant birds, come and go, but for the islanders, it's not always that easy.
Nantucket, it doesn't present a lot of opportunities, and what the fate is for too many people, I think, is that they come back here and they just stay here. They're bound here by these invisible strings. I know kids who have just given up already and be like, well, I'm not going to make it off the island. Might as well stay here, become a carpenter, and just do the living of the island.
See that chipmunk? It's a northern water thrush.
Skylar remembers his spark bird. That's the bird that flips a switch in a birder's brain. His
was a scarlet tanager, which was just hopping about in my yard. And to see that little brightly colored gem of a bird was really something else. I said to myself, if there are other birds out there, anything like this bird I'm looking at right now, I want to see them all.
Skylar hasn't seen them all yet. After all, he's only been a birder for about 2 years. But he's determined. Like a lot of birders, Skylar has a life list. He's kept track of every different bird he's seen. Right now, his total is roughly 412. But Skylar takes it to the next level. He tracks how many birds he sees annually, breaking his personal record every year.
I love feeling like I'm at the top of my game. I'll go out for a big day and I'll get 100 plus species, and it's just an exhilarating feeling of winning. That rush of like, oh, you're gonna do this, you're gonna get the big year. It's those sort of small feelings of victory that keep me going.
But the fact is, there aren't many birders on Nantucket to appreciate his victories. It's a small community. And he told me he's the only young birder on the island. He's tried to convince his friends, but...
none of them have ever converted. Birding for me is like a religion. I'm a Jehovah's Witness of birding. I'll be out with friends and I'll notice things that they don't even think to notice. It astonishes me that normal people do not pick up on these things. It almost seems alien to me when we'll be walking and I hear a flock of bobolinks going overhead, and they go on talking like it never even happened. It's like having little tiny voices in your head, you know?
So we've seen both types of kinglets today. That's pretty good.
Skylar might get discouraged sometimes about the future of birding on Nantucket or his future in general. But for now, he knows exactly where to go for inspiration.
You go out to the Cranberry Bogs, and there's Hudsonian godwits there that have been to the ends of the earth and back. I'm just a 15-year-old kid trapped on an island, but these birds, they have the whole earth to explore and to conquer. And that's kind of the freedom I get when I'm out birding. I get it.
For WCAI's Ways of Life, I'm Matthew Simonson on Nantucket.
For only birding a couple years, he sure knows his birds, huh? Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason why I said at first that this was an amazing find is because Skylar wasn't just a birder. He was able to tie his birding into a larger issue mm-hmm. that young people face on Nantucket. Mm-hmm. So this became a more universal story.
Yeah.
And that's, you don't always find that.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
As regular listeners know, throughout the broadcast day, we sprinkle in these 30 to 60 second pieces of audio that we call sonics. And you try to get the transom students to collect these sound bites for sonics. So to transom students or others who aren't familiar with sonics, how do you describe them to them?
Well, the assignment to the students is just go find people and talk to them. The way Jay puts it, if they're wearing an interesting hat, Jay Allison, the guy who runs transom, if they're wearing an interesting hat, go interview them. It gives the students practice on interviewing strangers, wearing the gear, having to deal with wild sound that's all around them. But for the station, you know, every radio station needs to identify itself. It needs to say this is WCAI and where it's from and that sort of thing. And oftentimes it's just something that's thrown in the middle of an announce break when an announcer is on it. But it can be programming.
Mm-hmm.
And it can help not only identify the station, but identify this place.
Yeah, sense of place, totally. Yeah, exactly. So we're going to hear a couple of them. And I'm not even going to, I think last time we did this, I gave away the the topic. So I'm going to let you introduce these.
Well, I think we should just hear them, although I will say about this one, I think you need to lean into your radio a little closer to understand because the accent's heavy.
This is some stuff that I've been wanting to get rid of for years. And so I call them and I said, can I burn today? I said, yes. Okay. So I started the fire.
Leonard Marks of East Falmouth.
I got steel barrels, burned the whole pile quicker. I only got till May, no more burning. Most of that is wood. Now my daughter's watching it, and she's cleaning up this yard, boy. Leaves, you see all the leaves out here? She's raked all these leaves, I guess, a dozen times. Oh, I come out, help her. Said, my dad gave me this land years and years ago when I was a kid.
You're listening to WCAI. Yeah.
You can hear that fire.
Wow, that's a really good recording
it
of that
really
fire.
Is, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the student, like I said, just interview people who look like they're interesting. And so the student was driving down, I think it was 6A, I'm going to say in Brewster, but I'm, oh no, wait a minute, this is East Falmouth. What am I talking about? My bad, confusing it with another one. Just saw him out burning leaves in the spring and said, all right.
Let's go see what's going on.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
All right, let's have it here another.
Okay.
We met at the landfall down in Woods Hole. Yeah, I was on a fishing trip, and she was a bartender, and we just hit it off.
Rhett Wheeler and Maddie LaCroix from Falmouth.
And I flew out probably like every 3 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever and would come out here and visit her. And then
and fish.
And fish.
And fish. Yeah, well. Yeah, he'd come and fish too.
Do you think he was coming for the fishing or for you?
I like to think me, but I know the fish had a huge part of it, and that's okay. Like, he
Why
loves
can't
it.
I have both? I could have my cake and eat it too, you know? Jeez.
You're listening to WCAI.
That's cute.
Alvin Melleth produced that. He was a student this past fall.
All right, we got a couple more.
If we got a Sunday afternoon to go to the beach, it was a family event, which we had to plan for. Mother would pack a picnic lunch, but we had to come home to milk the cows. More children nowadays spend much more time because they've got time on their hands. They haven't got farms to take care of and chores to do and that kind of thing. They've got time on their hands. So they go to the beach and party and go swimming and all that kind of stuff. We never had time for that. We were working on the farm.
That's Carolyn Crowell. She lives in Sandwich.
Mm-hmm. All right, we got one more.
Well, you got the full bunker gear on, and now you're putting the Scott Air Pack on, and that's what we have to wear. Any call of the truck, this is what you got to come every time, ready to go to work.
Firefighter Terrence Rogers in Falmouth.
Oh, I love my job. Best job in the world. You figure if someone dials 911, they're calling you because they're having one of the toughest times of their life. When you think of firefighter, you think of someone that's going to help you. We show up, people are happy. The police show up, you're like, oh, what'd I do?
It's a good one.
Yeah, and the ID goes in the middle there in that little blank spot. You'd say you're listening to WCAI. Right. Yeah.
Those are fun. We're talking about the Transom Story Workshop, training the next generation of radio producers with Rob Rosenthal. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the Transom Story Workshop, training the next generation of radio producers with Rob Rosenthal, who is the lead instructor. As we mentioned earlier, you've been doing this workshop for quite a while now.
Yeah,
a number
since
of years.
2011 we started.
So where have some of the students ended up? Are they voices we might hear on other NPR programs? Where do they go?
Well, one student's work that we heard just at the beginning of the show, she just graduated this fall. She's now the intern at Planet Money, or she'll be starting there soon. Mm-hmm. We're about to listen to a story by Alvin Melleth, and he has the fellowship at This American Life soon. And those are just recent successes, if you will. Others are at the mothership. They're at NPR, or they're working for podcasts like the Gimlet Podcast Network, or they're working at radio shows, or they're doing audio tours. Like, they're all over the place. It's kind of stunning, really.
Yeah.
We did some math, sort of unofficial, but I think we're pretty close. About a year ago, we did the math, and we've discovered that close to two-thirds of the students, I think it was 68% of the students, were interning or working in audio storytelling somewhere.
Wow, that's
a pretty good success rate.
You take the Transom Workshop on the road as well. So where are some of the places you go, and how do these road workshops differ from the workshops here in Woods Hole?
The traveling workshops are 1 week long. The workshop here on the Cape is 9 weeks long. You know, I'm going to state the obvious. We figured out that there are people who can't take 9 weeks off from their lives, financially, time-wise, you know, whatever. And so we've decided, all right, let's come up with one-week workshops and take them to people. So this past summer, I was in California, Michigan, Montana, Boston, and Georgia. And just a couple of weeks ago, I was in Marfa, Texas. And soon I'll be in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm going back to New York City in February. So yeah, I get like the best job in the world.
Yeah, I get to travel all over the place. All right, so we have one final story to hear. What do you want to tell us about this?
The student, Alvin, He really wrestled with this. This is a complicated, complicated story. And he hasn't produced many radio pieces before. This has a lot of moving parts. There's conflict in it, international intrigue. And he reported it all from here. And man, Alvin, he burned the midnight oil to make this just right.
When you're looking for a shipwreck, a 500-year-old shipwreck, arguably one of the most important undiscovered shipwrecks in human history, at some point, you've got to get into a boat, equipped with a really powerful magnometer, basically a really big magnet, and then you do just about the most boring thing imaginable.
We surveyed literally like mowing the lawn.
That's Barry Clifford.
You just put it on a chart, you know, with your computer, and you go back and forth on these lines. And we found, I think, 430 targets that we investigated.
Those 430 targets are the remnants of shipwrecks, lots of them. But back in 2014, Barry was looking for just one off the coast of Haiti. The Santa Maria. Yes, that Santa Maria, of the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria.
That's where we found the remains of the shipwreck with the two Lombards, the 8th and 9th Lombards ever discovered in the Western Hemisphere.
Lombards are 15th century cannons. And Barry thought, these Lombards have to be part of the Santa Maria shipwreck. So he made a big claim.
How sure are you that this is the Santa Maria?
I'm extremely confident that we've discovered the wreck site.
And that claim made headlines around the world.
An underwater explorer says he may have found the remains of Christopher Columbus's ship,
Santa Maria.
This could be the historical find of a lifetime.
It was a perfect story. Swashbuckling explorer finds 500-year-old shipwreck. There was only one problem.
Do you think that the Santa Maria was found?
No, it has not been found yet. It's certainly not where Barry Clifford said it was.
Erica Guerin is in charge of underwater cultural heritage at UNESCO. It's an arm of the United Nations, and it oversees cultural sites with global significance. Erica says that after Barry made his announcement, Haiti's Minister of Culture contacted her. The minister wanted a team of archaeological experts to verify Barry's claims.
But honestly, I mean, you know, it took 5 minutes to confirm what we already thought, that this is not the Santa Maria. What Mr. Clifford proposed to be the Santa Maria contained bronze nails. So the Santa Maria did not, for 100% sure, contain bronze nails. So there is no question that this is not the Santa Maria.
They never talked to me. They never looked at any of our records. UNESCO just came in and said, no, that's not it.
Barry's frustrated because he's been in this exact situation before. In 1982, Barry claimed that he determined the location of a pirate ship called the Witta. In 1717, the Witta shipwrecked off the coast of Cape Cod during a violent nor'easter. People had been looking for the shipwreck for almost 300 years.
Some of them were naysayers from the get-go. A lot of them were saying, you know, there's nothing out there. We told you that. It's just the Witta is just a folklore story.
That's Bob Sombrola. He's an archaeologist who worked with Barry on the Witta site. And he remembers after Barry made the claim, in those early years, it was a struggle.
It's frustrating. I'd be lying if I said it wasn't frustrating.
They were looking for proof, and for years they were coming up empty-handed. The doubters were growing louder. TV crews would come to the site to report that Barry still hadn't found anything. And then, in 1985, he finally did. He found something, something definitive. A bell that, after you brushed away hundreds of years of rust and sand, had a simple inscription on it.
The Witta Galley, 1716. The bell removed all doubt. That was the best feeling.
35 years later, Barry still has a chip on his shoulder about the whole thing.
These are the same people now that are saying that we didn't find this ship. Okay, the people in 1983 that said, no, this is not the Witta. He's crazy. He's got a nice soft room. We're going to put him in so he doesn't hurt himself. Paul Johnson is the same person that said that to you, probably.
Maritime, can I help you?
Hi there, is that Dr. Paul Johnson? Paul Johnson's been a curator at the Smithsonian Institution for almost 30 years, and he's been a critic of Barry Clifford for even longer. Do you think Barry Clifford found the Santa Maria?
No. The story just doesn't really seem to hold together.
Paul's got a lot of stories about Barry's claims. Like the time Barry said he found the tea chest from the Boston Tea Party. He hadn't. Or the time he said he found a bar of pirate silver off the coast of Madagascar. He didn't. Paul says Barry has a habit of getting out in front of himself.
No professional archaeologist would make a claim to have found something like Columbus's Santa Maria without ironclad proof, because one's reputation depends on that. But treasure hunters have no problem making those kinds of claims.
Treasure hunter. In the world of underwater archaeology, it's as close as you can get to a four-letter word.
All they want to do is recover valuable items and sell them. That's where there's a problem, because usually those valuable items only represent a tiny fraction of the entire archaeological site.
In 2016, Barry opened the Whydah Museum.
This is the real story.
The most striking thing about this place is that it kind of feels like an average museum. There are exhibits of silver coins and cannons, placards of historical context about the golden age of piracy. There's even a lab in the back offering a peek into the conservation process. When the UNESCOs and the Smithsonians of the world call Barry a treasure hunter, he points to this museum. Barry says he hasn't sold any of the Whydah find. Nothing. He says he's kept the entire Whydah collection intact, between two museums and a traveling exhibition that tours the country.
Millions of people have seen this exhibit. That's my payoff.
But selling treasure in bits and pieces isn't the only way to make money. Barry Clifford profits from the Whydah find in a much more modern way, by selling Barry Clifford. He's got books, specials with National Geographic and the History Channel. He's even sold the rights to his life story and the story of the Whydah. Bob Sombrola, the archaeologist that works with Barry, says all that publicity invites even more criticism.
There's a certain mindset that they all have. They feel that every shipwreck in the world is reserved for them and their buddies. And anybody from outside their elite group who wants to do anything with those shipwrecks is highly suspect in their eyes, because it's somebody from outside the clique.
Barry agrees, but he goes one step further. He thinks he's a casualty in a larger political conspiracy.
The last thing they wanted was for an American to find that ship.
And the thing is, once you get Barry going on UNESCO...
I don't know if you saw the New York Times yesterday, but we just backed out of UNESCO yesterday. UNESCO is not a friend of the United States. Got a whole notebook filled with articles about they're not a friend of Great Britain. It's in their mission statement to destroy all private sector archaeology. The United States backed out of UNESCO yesterday, and they're not a friend of Israel. From my perspective, the organization should be disbanded.
Well, it's not that we have our special, you know, targeted person or something like that. I mean, we work on the request of governments.
Arika Guerin says this isn't personal. UNESCO doesn't have some campaign against Barry. She says their only concern is safeguarding shipwreck sites from exploitation. She mentions the Belitung in Indonesia and the Atocha in the Florida Keys, shipwrecks that were commercially salvaged and had their artifacts sold at auction to the highest bidder. So she thinks Barry's problem isn't UNESCO at all. It's a much more practical one.
I think he has a certain talent to make ministers of culture very furious.
Including the Minister of Culture in Haiti. 2 months after Barry's press conference declaring he found the Santa Maria, Haiti revoked his permit. No more searching in Haitian waters. But Barry's still set on proving his claim.
I just want to go there and finish our investigations and identify the wreck.
To do that, Haiti's new Minister of Culture will have to renew Barry's permit. He thinks his odds are pretty good, and he's convinced he's right.
I'm more confident about the Santa Maria than I was about the Whydah.
And once again, for the moment at least, he's just about the only one. For WCAI, I'm Alvin Melleth.
Wow, you're right. Complicated story. That's a big story to take on when you're just beginning.
He almost dropped it, you know, because there were a lot of balls and there were a lot of different facets to that story. And it was pretty overwhelming, but he made it work.
Yeah.
He made it work. And he always wanted to start with the Whydah.
Mm-hmm.
But we were like, no, you got to start with the Santa Maria. And then people doubt him. But then you prove that he's got chops and he mm-hmm. found the Whydah. And he worked really hard to sculpt that piece.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are the ground rules that you can see some of these students kind of going off in these directions. You want to make sure they stay safe and
yes.
you make sure that they get correct information. So how does that all work?
Yeah, that's a good question. Safety. Well, the vast majority of the time, I think the students are safe. But there are times when they will run into people who, shouldn't spend too much time with. Mm-hmm. Let's just put it that way, especially if you're alone. Mm-hmm. And so the students are told, quite bluntly, actually, that if you ever, ever feel like you're in a situation, and I don't think we heard any story today
No.
If you ever felt like you're in a situation where you have any reason to believe that you are unsafe, you're out of there. Mm-hmm. Just leave. Blame it on your editor. Take a fake phone call. Like, do whatever it is you need to do to get out of there, because there's absolutely no reason for you to put yourself in a difficult situation just to, you know, report a story for a class.
Right. What about guest instructors? You get some pretty interesting people visiting here in Woods
Hole. We have a parade. It's a parade of people.
Yeah.
This coming workshop in spring of 2018 in April and May, Ira Glass will stop by. Mm-hmm. That always...
always gets the students excited.
Oh, my God. Yeah. No, it doesn't. It freaks them out. They completely... There's a lot of nervous hands in the room. Shireen Marisol Meraji from NPR and Code Switch is also coming this spring. This past fall, Robin Semyon from This American Life, Robert Smith from Planet Money, Al Letson from Reveal stopped by. A lot of these people maybe you've heard here on CAI. Of course, locally, Sean Corcoran will stop by and talk about the issues facing the Cape and the islands in the South Coast. Ari Daniel, a science reporter who's done a lot of reporting for CAI and got his start here really with Transom, he stops by to talk about pitching, how to pitch stories to editors. Sam Brown from Transom comes and talks about doing multimedia work and that sort of thing. And then we also take the students up to Boston. We got to do a road trip. So we go visit The World at WGBH. We also visit PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. And then we end the night at the Moth, and we go to a Moth event.
They're fun. Yeah. All right. So what's the vetting process? I'm sure you get a lot more than 9 people wanting to take these workshops.
Over 80 people applied for spring 2018. And there's a team of 2 people, Sam and Sid, both from Transom. They will go through and cull out about half of them. And then they send on the other half to a committee of people who then reviews them, scores them. And right as this is being recorded, there's literally a meeting at my house happening where people are going through and talking about who should come, who should be first to be brought, and then the backups.
And of course, there may be someone's going, yeah, I would be interested in either attending a workshop, or maybe there are people interested in hearing more stories. And you do have a website. Is that how they apply, through the website?
Yeah, transom.org. Transom.org is the website. All of the student stories from all of the semesters or workshops, I should say, dating back to 2011 are up at transom.org. And the applications for future workshops are up there as well.
Because you've already reached the deadline for spring. So this would be next fall.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Right.
And how do you, the people who are getting you on the road, how do you determine that?
You know what? I'm going to blow your mind, and I'm also going to pat us on the myself on the back. They call us.
Oh, really? Okay.
We've never called out.
Oh, wow.
And said, hey, would you like a workshop? So places where they're – often it's our hosts are public radio stations. Yeah. So in Michigan, it's Interlochen Public Radio. Oh, and they're very interested in having a training component at the radio station.
Rob Rosenthal, lead instructor at the Transom Story Workshop that takes place each fall and spring in Woods Hole. We'll have a link to hear more stories and information about Transom at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks, Rob, for sharing with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.